The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Further, I'll go ahead and introduce our speakers. First up, we have Dave Zirin. Dave is the sports editor at The Nation. New York Times bestseller and awesome names, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable.
About this amazing conference, we have breaking World Cup news. The United States still not playing. That's too bad, because what we really needed this past week was more nationalism. I mean, not sure. So let's get started with Socialism 2018. I was realizing the other day, much to my shock, that this is my 25th conference. Like, no clap. It's just, my niece is here as a registered attendee, and they were negative 12 when I went to that. It's mind-boggling to me. And it is true. I tell family and friends that when it's Socialism weekend, there can be no weddings, there can be no family reunions, there can be no bar mitzvahs. It is not happening. Not even an anti-Zionist bar mitzvah. I don't know if you know what that is. That's when the rabbi says, "You're a man, now go free Palestine." Not even those are allowed to be mitzvahs. And every last one of them has felt special and important and invigorating for the work that we have to do back in our hometowns. And that was true even when it was just a handful of us in rural Ohio doing meetings like, "The internet, what is this shit?" But I believe that there has never been a more important one than this year, in all sincerity. There has never been a more important socialism conference than this one in 2018. And I believe that for two reasons. I mean, first of all, of course, Donald Trump and his racist assault on our most basic rights. And two, because of the way that the Democratic Party has shown itself incapable of standing up to his fascist-minded agenda. And sincerely, I say this, and I bet a lot of you feel it too. This puts us in a very scary place. The scariest place in my political lifetime is 2018, right here in the USA. Because the greatest threat that Trump represents to me is that he becomes the new normal, that his policies become the new normal, that things that would have been unheard of even a couple of years ago, like travel bans, Charlottesville, the response to Puerto Rico, the horrific slaughter of Palestinians, and the vicious attacks on immigrants and refugees, the fear is that that becomes the new normal. Well, guess what? We are the resistance to the new normal. Republican who doesn't get invited to the White House now gets to say they're part of the resistance. And I'm sorry, Bill Kristol, you're not part of my resistance. FBI, you're not part of my resistance. Sorry about that.
We got the guillotine. You better
know. Okay. So what is the resistance? I mean, the resistance is obviously not just the people in this room. Thank God. It is the teachers on the march from West Virginia, said Me Too and time's up to the Harvey Weinstein of this world. It is the athletes, yes, the football players, for goodness sakes. Environment, and it is the thousands who shocked the Democratic Party establishment and voted to send the socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And it is a resistance that says, and I hope you're listening in the back, God damn this Supreme Court to hell. We are going to fight. Trumpites out there, I think we have to put them on notice that the harm and pain that they are causing will provoke an even greater response. The Trumpites, I don't know if there are any in this room, I don't know if any of them have their cameras out, whatever they're doing, but look, you love the Bible, or at least you say you do. And it might be good for you to remember what's in the book of Hosea, where it said, they that sow the wind shall reap the whirlwind. That whirlwind is the resistance. That's what this weekend will be all about. But there's another reason that makes this 2018 conference so special. It's not just the times we're living in, it's the history. This is the 50th anniversary of 1968. The revolutionary year. And there's so much that we're doing this weekend devoted to the lessons of that year. 1968 was the year of the Tet Offensive, the French general strikes, the Prague Spring, the urban rebellions that have followed the assassination of Dr. King. And if there was one moment that crystallized this revolutionary resistance, it was at the 1968 Olympics, when John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their fists to the heavens. Shit when you're riding the fence. Thank you very much.
In the chair that you're sitting in today, and
been so inspired by everything that I've always heard and been inspired by just the number of people that are here every year and always take away just so much more life than what I came with. Just given everything that we're put through throughout the year in between Socialism Conference. And so, you know, if you're here today, I'm really hoping that I could serve to provide some of that hope and inspiration for y'all, and to also just be inspired by your commitment to be here to learn and to join an organization, whether it's us or whether it's any organization that will help to advance social justice for all people across the world. When I told my dad that I was joining a socialist organization a couple of years ago, you know, my mom said, in conjunction, they both said, "Te gusta la mala vida," which is like, you like the bad life. And they said, "Do you not know what happens to young people like you who think they can change the world?" And the first example they gave me was actually 1968, what happened in Mexico, which was actually hosting the Olympics, and so prior to that had been in an ongoing struggle against the government to shed international light to the ongoing poverty, the ongoing dispossession of agricultural workers and indigenous people, the continued repression of unionized workers, the continued repression of students who were trying to get free education, who were trying to increase the quality of education and provide education for people in the rural parts of Mexico. And so leading up to the Olympics, they held some pretty huge marches, numbering in the thousands. And so, you know, on the night before, like, one of the opening ceremonies of the Olympics, they held a huge demonstration in Tlatelolco. And this is when the Mexican government, which had been monitoring the activity of the main organizing student groups and unions that were mobilizing for this action, in conjunction with the CIA, actually repressed that entire movement by completely murdering. And I'm talking about kidnapping and murdering overnight hundreds and thousands of students who had gathered. And to this day, this is actually something that Mexicans all know happens, but that the government has refused to acknowledge, and even to the extent that they do now admit that there was a repression and that students were kidnapped, they refuse to admit the extent of the operation, the extent of which it was a collaboration with imperialist USA, and the extent to which the torture that happened and the ongoing lack of acknowledgement, you know, made it so that generations of people continued to fight for justice for their loved ones, you know, facing a complete state of impunity that refused to acknowledge their suffering. And all of this sounds very familiar today, but if one thing should lift your spirits is to know that the only reason the government now admits all of that is because people haven't stopped fighting. People haven't stopped mobilizing. The same struggle that were carried out then for education, for justice, for indigenous sovereignty are being taken up again. And there might have been decades of repression where people were too afraid, but ultimately, as long as there is oppression, there will be resistance. The horrific actions of the government of ICE, the complete impunity with which they're operating, I can't help but think of the kidnappings and the torture that people were put through back then, and how this is very much what's happening today. And so, when I, you know, in the midst of watching all of that, I talked to my mom. One of the stories that her and I were not able to shape was the case of Encarnacion Baín Romero. I want you to remember that name. Encarnacion Romero has been fighting for almost a decade. Because when in 2007, after coming here from Guatemala, a country that has been ravaged by US policies of military and economic intervention, she came to the US and was working in a chicken factory. And Encarnacion Romero became the victim of a targeted raid in her workplace. And her only crime was actually going to work that day. Nonetheless, she was detained and kept in a detention facility. And her child, who at the time was a toddler, was put into the care of her family members. But her family members were too burdened. They couldn't handle taking care of another child. They didn't know what to do with him. They didn't want to send him back home. They knew that they couldn't take care of him. So they asked, is there any couple that knows us that could take this child? And this is where Melinda and Seth, an American couple that was childless, stepped up to the plate and said, we can take care of the child. They took the child and gained custody of him and then eventually adopted him. This Guatemalan woman, Encarnacion, came out of the detention center not knowing what had happened to her child, not knowing where her child was. Eventually, she figured out the couple that had taken him into custody, that had adopted him, and tried to seek custody of her child. It has been an ongoing legal fight for 10 years. The child does not remember who she is, and the government keeps telling her that it's her history of having left her country where she has other family and other children, and it's her history of coming through the border and risking her own life, and it's her history of working illegally in this country and breaking the law by coming here that leads the government to believe that this woman is neglectful, that this woman cannot take care of her child, that she left her child vulnerable to dangers in the U.S. by being detained by the government that was criminalizing her for simply trying to provide for that child. My mom and I cannot shake this case because we know that it could have been us. In the last 30 years of an immigration wave coming from Latin America, from all over the world, it really could have been us. It wasn't, thank God, because we came right before 9/11, right before the government started to set up all kinds of agencies that could violate human rights and that could violate international law for the sake of national security. We came through the airport by a coyote. I came unaccompanied. And I was able to reunite with my parents and grew up, and now I'm involved in the immigrant rights movement because I know that we deserve all of the very things that citizens have today. For the fact that we work here, for the fact that we live here. For the fact that we love and we thrive despite everything that the US government throws at us and despite everything that our countries did to drive us out of them. And I can't shake this case particularly because my mom was 28 years old when she came here. She was my age. I'm 26, about to be 28, and she was a single mother who couldn't possibly have done any better. And in the last 10 years, we have seen politicians from every party, from every single position, use this justification of law and order, of national security, basically to say, we want only the people who will contribute to our continued dominance in the world and no one else. And throughout history, they will go to all lengths to traumatize us, to wear us down, to make us believe that this cannot change. But I want you to leave this plenary and to leave this conference knowing that every single agency, every single law, ICE itself, has not existed for eternity. It was created, and it was created for a purpose. And that purpose was to wear people down, to break them apart, and to make them think that they could not change what's happening. And in the 10 years that I've been in the immigrant rights movement, all of these things have been used to divide us not only along national, race, or gender lines, but also within our very families by criminalizing some of us and telling others. others that we made the right decisions and we deserve to stay. I have a brother who has a criminal record, and I was raised with him. And I ask every single politician, every person that does not believe that we deserve the right to stay, how it is possible that two children who were raised in the same household could now have their destiny determined on a one mistake that led to a couple of arrests in a society where 9 out of 10 people have contact with the police leading to some sort of infraction. In a world where if you are not working, you cannot pay your rent, you become homeless. How is it that two children growing up in the same household with the same loving parents could have such vastly different destinies? Simply for making one or two choices differently. It is not fair, and it is no longer fathomable that we will allow these continued practices to tear our families apart. And so I ask you today, and I know that we're in an interesting moment, and I'm gonna leave with this. I know that politicians are starting to hear our outcry, are starting to hear our rage, and are scrambling to come up with halfway solutions that will pacify us, that will make us complacent once again. And I know that the Democratic Party, trying to become the face of our resistance, are also scrambling to allow some of our ideology, some of our curiosity for socialism, so long as it does not threaten their pro-capitalist approach. That the Democrats deport, that the Democrats kidnap, that the Democrats signed all of these things into law, that the Democrats have stood there and told people like Encarnacion Romero, like my own mother, it is your fault. It is your fault that your children are suffering today. My mom, she says to me, I regret bringing you to this country because in Mexico I was poor, but I was fine. You are poor, and you are targeted, you are criminalized, you are terrorized. Last year, I began therapy, and I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not here to tell you that because it's my proclaimed sob story. I'm telling you because when I got that diagnosis, I was surprised. I have not been in a war. I'm not a veteran. And then I began to ask myself this question, why I became a socialist, why I'm standing here today, why I continue to come back even though a lot of the days I can't get up from bed, I can't find the motivation to keep going. And the reason is we have been in a war. We have been in a war for 10 years. We are all veterans. And whether we diagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder or not, we have been here and we have fought and we have suffered, and because of that, we have to win. And we will.
Disorienting and enraging and then disorienting again and then hopeful again, and it's just like, how do I get my head this. And I think if it weren't for conferences like this, I would not have a sense of what to do next, or that there was something that really was possible for us to do next. And I think that the most important thing we do in this room, the most important thing that people like Denise do, and Dave, the thing that we do is that we actually tell people that solidarity is the tool to win. And it's not just a good sentiment, it's actually the way that we are. The socialist gods for this conference. It's that it always falls around the 4th of July. And I would say this is an especially cynical 4th of July, maybe the most in living memory, because, well, you know, we're socialists, so it's always pretty cynical. Because we know this is a country that claims to be the greatest democracy on earth, and yet is a country that was founded on slavery and the genocide of indigenous people, that has done everything against democracy in countries all around the world by fomenting wars and making it less safe. We're in the richest country on earth, and yet we're in one of the most unequal societies on earth. But you don't have to be a revolutionary socialist to know that it is cynical today in Trump's America to celebrate the land of the free in a country that at this very moment is keeping children in cages, that won't hold racist cops accountable when they kill black people dead in the streets, where people can't afford basic health care and are dying literally of despair. So today, the most accurate description of the 4th of July comes from none other than the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass. America reigns without a rival. But alongside the horror, there is also resistance. Today, every single person in this room has come from all over the country, from different parts of the world, as part of struggles against these very atrocities. And I can't think of any better place to spend the next 4 days for figuring out how it is we can meet the enormous challenges ahead and fight for an urgently needed alternative to this sick, barbaric system called capitalism. It's also important to know what it is that we are fighting for. And to me, socialism is what it means to connect those fights, to connect all of these struggles to the fight for a society that puts people before profit, that is run by the people who actually make the society run, the working class. For that, it won't be enough to reform the system. We need to replace it. This didn't start with Trump. It started with the system that spawned him. Overthrowing this terrible society is not step one on the agenda. But it also points to why these conferences are so important. I always come away with a greater sense of clarity, of knowledge, of theory, about history and the struggles that came before, of analysis, whether that's from talks on the history of the labor movement in West Virginia, or about the struggle that's happening today, about the popular revolution against Assad's brutal regime in Syria, or on what kind of party it is that we need. Because there's no shortage of outrage, there has to be a question of what politics it's going to take to actually move these struggles forward. So I want to just say, I think the other aspect is not just to have the end goal in mind, but to actually figure out what it will take when we go back to our communities to convince many more of these people who are not yet radicals, who are outraged, what is it going to take to actually do something, and what can you actually do to go forward? And with the outrages of the immigrants being absolutely, under absolute attack right now, I think that the one thing that we can take as solace is that Trump is not invincible. It wasn't people or the Democrats or people at the top of society who changed things. It was the people who came out in masses. taxes that even forced Trump to step back and not go to the extent of the horrible policies that he wanted to implement. And so we need an even bigger movement. We need one that says that it's actually going to take more action like that in the streets in order to actually do it. And we also need organization. We actually have incredible people like John Carlos, like Demeter Frazier of the Combahee River Collective. Socialist, lesbian, feminists in the 1970s. We have heroes here like Spencer Rapone, a former Army Ranger and infantry officer who spoke out against the Army's imperialist wars and whose iconic photo you might have seen in which he's wearing his uniform showing us the inside of his hat with the words, "Communism will win." Society must be an international one. So take advantage of this weekend, of the incredible wealth of knowledge that we share between us. Participate in the discussions, bring on the debates, keep them comradely. So that at the end, we can come away with a sense of what it's going to take to approach this horrific system that we're up against, arm ourselves with the theory and history of our side, and bring that back to our communities to fight for the world that we all deserve. And I'll end on this. One of my comrades, Molly, actually said the thing that I think is most important about this conference, which is that it is one thing to have an abstract sense of what it means to actually fight for a better world and the necessity of it. It's another thing to be in a room full of 1,000 or plus other people who actually believe that that fight isn't possible. So we are
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.